This session is entitled The U.S. Healthcare System, Crisis and Contradiction. I am, for those of you who haven't been to my previous sessions, a medical doctor. I'm a pediatrician and an internist, and I'm currently practicing at the University of Washington. And this session, I actually, again, my apology to those of you who are going to be living halfway through the series, but I had conceived this session as being the first of a three-part series in the U.S. healthcare system. Today I thought that we would take a look at where our healthcare system is now. And obviously from the title, I think that we have some problems and there are some major contradictions in the way healthcare, the way we all receive healthcare in this country. And we're going to talk about that today. Tomorrow, I thought, as an interesting exercise in citizen democracy, that we would try and design an alternative healthcare system amongst all of us. If the politicians and the pundits can do it, why can't you or I? So I thought tomorrow we'd try and design our own healthcare system, and then use that as an exercise to help derive from that criteria whereby we can judge proposals for healthcare reform that are currently on the table, that are currently being discussed in the political arena. And then finally on Friday, what I had planned to do was to sort of lay out what I think the solution is, to present to you more the proposal that I think is the best. So the way I'd originally planned to divide these three sessions up was today was going to be a diatribe, tomorrow a discussion, and finally Friday was going to be a disclosure. And I think at the end of this session, for those of you who are leaving tomorrow afternoon, at the end of tomorrow's session, maybe we will want to jump ahead and take a little advanced look at Friday's session, because I had conceived of them as being apart together. Before we really get sort of going with the meat of the matter here, I thought I'd take a little bit of an introductory parenthesis and tell you primarily I'm going to be talking about the healthcare system as you know people usually think of it in this country, hospitals, doctors, nurses, x-ray machines, pharmacies, et cetera, et cetera. When someone sells healthcare to me, that's usually what I think of anyway, especially being a doctor and having that kind of bias. But there are two concepts derived primarily from the discipline of public health, and especially public health as learned and practiced in the developing world in the last two decades, that I think are useful and helpful for us to keep in the back of our minds as we discuss our healthcare system, more narrowly defined, over the next 3 days. And those two concepts about healthcare in general are, the first is that, reject that one. Forgot to check out my markers beforehand here. First, healthcare is an aggregate, how do you spell aggregate, of our overall situation. As an example, how many healthcare workers are there here? I guess I can raise my hand. I'm a doctor. How many others are there that are in healthcare or retired from healthcare? There's another. Okay, so we've got three. Keep your hands up. This is okay. Now, how many work or have worked or volunteered in areas of? Let me get my list out here so that I environmental health, public utilities or social services. Raise your hands if this qualifies. Food production, homemaking, childcare, education, religious ministries. Anything having to do with sort of construction of social of materials that our society uses. Come on, raise your hands, folks. Farming. Let's. Okay. So the point is, it's great to see so many healthcare workers here with me today. Actually, I'm not sure if that's great. Come to think of it, I came up to hold it partly to take a vacation from the healthcare setting, and here you all are, so I don't know. But the point is that healthcare looked at more broadly depends on a number of aspects of our society, and sort of looked at from this perspective, maybe there are a few occupations or activities in our society that don't have something to do with healthcare. There are a few, I think. There's a poster over in the Narnia Elementary room that repeats the old Women's International League slogan that war is not good for children and other living things. So maybe there's some aspects of war that are not particularly conducive to health. But the World Health Organization defines health or healthcare as having to do with the physical, social, and mental well-being of individuals. And I think to that I tend to add spiritual as well, to the extent that that's different from mental. And so the concept, the public health concept, is that there are a lot of things that go into health. And keep that in mind as we discuss healthcare in this country more narrowly defined. The other concept is that healthcare, or health rather, is a continuum. It's not something, good health is not something that you have or you don't have. Not something that you can either get or you don't get, but rather it's a continuum, something somewhere between, most of us fall between, say, death or being almost dead and being Jane Fonda or Karen Atkerson, the current Jane Fonda of Holden Village. My father, good thing Karen's not here. Probably a pejorative comparison. But the point is that health is along, or wellness is along, a spectrum. And I think that's an important concept to keep in mind too. Having said that, let's talk about our healthcare crisis, as it's often sort of referred to as a cliche in this country. People mean different things by the term healthcare crisis. For the national politicians, especially, reveal a little bit of my political bias here, for the Bush administration, I think the term healthcare crisis to them means something that's depressing their ratings in the polls, something that they have to do something about, but they're not sure what, because it's contributing to George Bush's political problem. To a number of doctors, the healthcare crisis means the rising costs of medical malpractice insurance. It means increasing office expenses, office overhead, to take care of increased sort of administrative and billing requirements. It means increased amounts of paperwork for the doctor themselves. For a number of hospital administrators, our healthcare crisis means more stringent restrictions on reimbursement for programs like Medicare and Medicaid. Difficulty for hospitals to make their budget when they take care of certain types of patients who are on certain types of public and increasingly private medical insurance plans. For business leaders, healthcare crisis means the spiraling, truly quickly escalating cost of employee health benefits. For labor leaders, it means sort of trimmings here and there, or increased co-pays on the health benefits of their members. It also means the increased acrimony of health benefits during labor negotiations. About three-quarters of labor strikes during the last decade have had health care benefits as a major aspect, as a major bone of contention. For insured individuals in the middle class, it means increasing premiums for your HMOs or for Blue Cross Blue Shield payments or whatever healthcare plan people might have. For small towns, for those of us who come from the Midwest and the West, this is, I think, an important issue. The healthcare crisis means difficulty keeping doctors and the fact that that smaller hospitals are being squeezed out of business. So I think there's a lot of different definitions of what people mean by the healthcare crisis. But today, I think I'd like to focus, at least to some degree, on the definition of healthcare crisis that it seems to me ought to be the case for Christians. And that is, this is truly a moral crisis. It's, I think, a crisis that really cuts to the quick of our gospel ethos and really asks us to reflect on what Jesus was about when he engaged in so many healings. Was actively involved in the healthcare of the people of his time. And in a sense, that's the case with the politics of healthcare too, because politics, after all, is simply our personal ethics, I think, translated into the social sphere, a concept that, as many of you know, dates back to the Greeks, to Aristotle, and also to the Bible to some extent. So, to set the stage for the moral aspects of this crisis, let me read a vignette that's shamelessly borrowed out of an article that I couldn't help but saying, oh man, I've been talking about this topic for a number of years, and Gordon Bonniman, who's somebody that I don't know, came along in the April Sojourners magazine, April 92, and wrote this absolutely wonderful article that I commend to all of you, and if you want to come and look at it after. And there are a number, for anybody who's worked in a public hospital in any major city, or for that matter, a number of hospitals in rural areas, there are numerous examples of individuals being denied care that any of us could cite. But I think none of them are quite so poignant or to the point as this one, and since he's got it down in paper, I thought I'd read this one rather than pulling ones out of my own experience. It's about Terry, who was a 24-year-old construction worker who suffered from diabetes since childhood. Like most construction workers, Terry's job carried with it no health benefits, and with his medical record, Terry could not buy an individual health insurance policy at any price. During recurrent diabetic crises, Terry built up a large bill at Methodist Hospital in Somerville, Tennessee, where he lived. One afternoon, a neighbor in Terry's trailer park came over to visit him after work. She found him quite ill and called an ambulance. He was taken to Methodist Hospital, and a physician examined him and found him to be suffering from a diabetic condition known as acute ketoacidosis, and therefore admitted him immediately to the hospital, to Methodist Hospital. Terry had been in the hospital less than an hour when word reached the acting administrator that Terry had been admitted. Alarmed at the prospect of the young man incurring another bill that he would be unable to pay, the hospital official personally went to Terry's hospital room, lifted him under the arms, and dragged him out of the building, leaving him propped under a tree in the hospital parking lot. His neighbor found him there a short time later, clad only in pants and a t-shirt. Indignant, she called the hospital, which confirmed that he could not receive care because he had failed to pay his earlier bills. The neighbor took Terry back home to his trailer, laid him on his couch, and tried to make him as comfortable as she could. That's where he was found dead the following morning. It may seem like a surprising scenario, but the fact of the matter is that for patients who are repeatedly admitted to the hospital and can't pay their bills, the hospital eventually has those patients sign a statement that says, you know, I agree to pay my bills, and if I don't from now on, I agree to waive my right to be admission, to be admitted. And under duress, almost all patients sign that sort of statement. And then, you know, a situation as happened to Terry can happen. I think the current number is that there are about 37 million Terrys in this country, that is to say 37 million Americans without health insurance and, for the most part, without personal means to pay. As I said, it's clearly a moral issue, and therefore I think it's an issue for the church. And one question that I ask myself is, why has the church, and to some extent, since I think the church is with society at large here and not necessarily out in front of it, but certainly, you know, the church is now with the society and the political system at large asking, you know, what is going on here? Why has the church and why has our society been so slow to sort of recognize the moral implications of this problem? How many are familiar with the term fee for service? It's what probably many of us still receive when, or still. Arrange when we go to a physician, to a private physician. We go, fee for service means that we go to a doctor with a health concern, with an illness, with something, you know, health in the health arena that we need done for ourselves. The physician or other healthcare provider takes care of that problem for us, gives us a bill, and we pay the fee. Get a service, pay the fee. And this has been the dominant sort of economic organizing principle of American medicine, certainly in most Western medical systems since the 1800s, or in some sense before that. It's true that it's changed a lot in the last 20 years, particularly in major urban centers, especially in the Midwest and the Pacific Northwest, with the advent of managed care and HMOs. But still, even with managed care systems and HMOs, like, for example, group health in Seattle and in the Twin Cities and in large parts of Minnesota, it's still a similar system. The only difference, really, with that is that you pay the fee ahead of time, but it's still sort of fee for service. In the old days, fee for service, in some respects, worked pretty well, especially in small towns. There's maybe one or two doctors. Those who could pay and could reimburse the physician did, and there were enough of those individuals that physicians could survive and make a living and do fine. Then physicians in most small town communities considered it their moral obligation to take care of those who couldn't pay as well. And so alongside fee-for-service, there developed a system of charity care, of medical charity, which served well. And to some extent that was the case in larger cities as well, but I think it's true that in larger cities, medical charity has never completely taken care of those who needed to be taken care of. And increasingly in larger cities, the avenues for charity care, that is to say two avenues of basically public hospitals or public facilities, public clinics, and church hospitals and clinics, have been unable to keep up with that need. Part of the reason is that public money for public hospitals has been decreasing, and the church medical facilities have been increasingly less charity institutions and increasingly more a part of the larger medical marketplace. Many of them are large bureaucratic, healthcare organizations, and have lost to a large degree, although not entirely, some of their charity component to them, some of the charity component to their reason for existence. So essentially, the system can't keep up anymore, and there are millions of Terrys in the country. I think what I'd like to do now is to sort of delve into some of the statistics and some more of the details behind the crisis to give you a better sense of where we are right now. And to do that, I brought along a number of slides that I've prepared, and I've also borrowed for some other individuals for other purposes, for giving talks to other audiences. But I think that a lot of them are very helpful, although most of them are in sort of graph form. Can one of you back there flip the top switch in the upper left corner? Just turn it all, push it all the way toward the front, the top. Yeah, all the way farther. A couple more clicks this way. The top switch, the one above.
Top. There.
Yeah, push it all the way this way.
It's all the way over.
It is. There we go. Oh, okay. Maybe it was the bottom one. I'm sorry. All right. Can you folks see that reasonably well? Okay. We clearly have a problem with We clearly have a problem with rising healthcare costs in this country. In 1985, right now we're spending $819 billion in healthcare in this country. That's double what we were spending. Thank you. Actually, you might want to pull the back curtain there as well. That's double what we were spending back in 1985, and that's expected to double again by the year 2000. Right now, that $819 billion is 13.5% of our gross national product, and it's on that's the problem. It's on automatic click. One of those is Let me just run back and get it myself. Did you flick off the automatic switch? Let me see if we're okay there. Sorry. Should have done it with. Okay. Here we go. Okay. I think it's all right. Thank you, Esther. Back in 1985, we were spending 10.3% of our gross national product. Now it's up to 13.5% of our gross national product on healthcare. That is in contradistinction. Let me just slip back there and turn it off. There's a button there that says automatic timer or timer. But in contradistinction, really all other countries of the developed world spend roughly 8 to 9% of their gross national product on healthcare. The United States spends the most on healthcare of any country in the world. The next country behind us that spends the second largest amount per capita on healthcare is Canada. And Canada spends about 40% less than we do. As you can see, in the last 5 years or so, Canada has pretty much stabilized its healthcare spending each year at about 8 to 9%, as have most developed countries. But the U.S. has continued to rise on an exponential curve in how much we spend. Despite this expense, as I said, this slide is about a year and a quarter old or so. There are now 37 million uninsured individuals like Terry in this country. This accounts for about 14% of our population, and the number is, of course, rising rapidly. Uninsured individuals come from all walks of life. People who can't pay for medical insurance are all of us, essentially. More likely, however, to be poor, 22%, about a fifth of the uninsured. Uninsured are more likely to be young adults, just getting started in life. Again, about a fifth of young adults are uninsured. Here's a slide showing that the number of uninsured Americans are rising rapidly. It's still sort of on an exponential curve along with the amount of money that we're spending on healthcare. Of the uninsured, about 40% are employed individuals. Only 7% of those who have no health insurance are unemployed, which I think is a sort of a surprising statistic to many individuals. About a third of the unemployed are children, of the uninsured are children, thank you. And this slide doesn't show it, but the proportion of African Americans is higher than the proportion of Caucasians that is uninsured. So to some extent, this is an issue of racism. It's even worse among Hispanic Americans, who have a rate of uninsurance of about twice that of Caucasians. There's really only a couple occupation groups that have universal health insurance, and that is legislators and judges, which I think is a starkly interesting statistic. The 37 million figure, the automatic focus isn't quite working here. Doesn't completely tell the tale either. This is from a study that the Census Bureau did back in the late 80s of about a 2.5 year period. And what they did was they essentially figured out how many individuals went without insurance for at least a month or more, and found out that 63 million of us were without insurance for at least a month or more, were completely without any health coverage of any type, which is a quarter of the population. And so at some point during that 2.5 years, 1/4 of the population was at risk of financial ruin and severe financial hardship and or severe health hardship because of the because of lack of insurance. I wonder if the automatic focus button got flicked off there. In addition to the uninsured, there's a large percentage of us, about double, who are underinsured, that is to say, individuals who have partial coverage. As this says, Medicare only pays about 50%, or actually less than 50% of seniors' medical bills, doesn't cover long-term care very well, doesn't cover prescription drugs, doesn't cover things like co-pays and deductions, deductibles. There's a large number of us with medical coverage that if they had a major illness like heart disease of a you know, major degree or a cancer of some type or a major hospitalization, that they would be bankrupt. I think it's an interesting and poignant statistic that on the average, senior citizens in America are spending 18% of their income for out-of-pocket medical expenses. And with a number of senior citizens on fixed incomes, that's just prohibitive. In addition, as a very worrisome statistic, that there are 5 million young women in this country in their childbearing years who have insurance that has no maternity benefits to it. And so essentially, these are women who have a major financial disincentive for getting prenatal care of any type. Access problems of insured Americans, sort of a part of the underinsured story, is a study done by a researcher at the University of Michigan about 5 years ago now that found that when they talked to adults with serious or chronic illnesses, that illness was a major financial problem for many of them, and because of that, about a fifth of them saw no doctor during the preceding year. These are conditions that would ordinarily be considered the sort of thing that you would want to go and see a doctor for on a relatively frequent basis, like every month or every other month, to keep it under control. And in addition, a significant number of them, 15%, couldn't get the sort of ancillary therapy that they needed, like prescription drugs or physical therapy. This is another slide of another way of showing that the cost to senior citizens for medical care is rising markedly over the last two decades, or actually the last decade and a half, from 12% in 1977 to now actually up to more like 20% actually in 1992. This 18.1 figure was from 1988. Now there's another aspect to this, the whole moral crisis of medical care in this country, and again, I think this goes back to the World Health Organization view of healthcare. But it's important to realize that poverty is also a major issue. That some of the things that we're going to discuss in a minute here about how we're doing in terms of our health in this country has not only to do with access to medical care as narrowly defined, but also has to do with the broader social situation. During the 1960s, we clearly did a promising job. We did not eliminate poverty in this country, but we clearly made some significant headway in reducing the number of individuals in poverty in this country. And then we sort of stabilized during the 1970s, and poverty rates jumped markedly in this country during the 1980s. And there was a little bit of dip with strong economic growth during the late 80s, but basically we're now on the rise again, as evidenced by the Los Angeles riots and a number of other, you know, social indicators that we see in our headlines of the newspaper. I always want to pull this slide out every time I hear a politician say that the social programs of the 1960s didn't work. This is not primarily having to do with healthcare. This is having to do with social programs, publicly funded social programs. So that's something to keep in the back of our minds, I think, when we talk about healthcare. So what has, we've gone through the statistics of who is unable to get care and who's unable to get adequate care. What is this doing for our health in this country? Well, the first thing that it's doing is cases similar to Terry's. This is a hospital chart from a public hospital, and what it says was that there was a 21-year-old woman who was in a motor vehicle accident last night, and she was seen at a private hospital that shall remain nameless unless you can read that, and public hospital emergency room and admitted to the public hospital, was transferred from the private hospital to the public hospital because she had no insurance. In essence, she was what physicians now call patient dumping. Per year, in the last few years, 300,000 Americans have been denied services in emergency rooms because they had insufficient means to pay. So patient dumping is a major phenomenon, not just from hospital admissions, but also simply from emergency rooms. If you don't have insurance and you go to the wrong emergency room, you may be in serious trouble. This chart is particularly a stark because this woman had a major motor vehicle accident and had severe internal bleeding required subsequently, when she finally got the care that she needed, a 12-hour operation to control her internal bleeding. Had major complications, which, had they been jumped on quicker, probably would not have been such a, still would have been a serious condition, but would probably not have been catastrophic. Lack of ability to pay for Americans is also causing major problems for our ability to provide preventive care to individuals in this country. There are a number of studies that show this, and I've just abstracted one of them for you. This is a study of women between ages 45 and 65, an age group where we clearly have documented that preventive care techniques, things like checking blood pressure, doing a annual or every other year pap smear, doing breast exams, and checking for vision problems due to glaucoma, it's clearly documented that those are very health-maintaining, very cost-effective as well, things to do for people's health to prevent illness. And it's clear, as you can see, that those who have insurance are in the purple are doing much better than those in the green that don't have insurance in terms of their ability to get a hold of or to participate in these preventive healthcare services. The same is for men, the same is for children. There are also a number of studies, some of which are relatively technical, and so I haven't really decided to put them on a slide, that clearly document that for individuals with serious medical conditions, things like cancer or high blood pressure or diabetes or various forms of chronic heart disease, that their chances of dying, or that their likelihood of dying and the state of their health is going to be much worse if they don't have insurance and don't have the means to pay for medical care than if they do have insurance. So it's clear that even for established diseases, being able to see a physician or being able to get to a healthcare setting on a regular basis helps prevent worsening of illness. The United States has a couple unique features that it shares with South Africa among all developed nations. One of those features is it's really the only country among the developed countries that does not provide universal access to care. The other interesting feature is that the United States is really the only other country that doesn't keep aggregate health statistics by socioeconomic status. However, we do keep aggregate health statistics by racial status, and so to some extent we can extrapolate, since we know that a greater percentage of, for example, African Americans are poor than white Americans, and we know that a greater percentage of African Americans lack insurance than white Americans, we can extrapolate to some degree from comparisons between or from health statistics among African Americans to what the effects of lack of insurance or lack of ability to pay for medical care are. And so that's what this slide attempts to do. I think again, you know, using this technique to some extent points out the racism inherent in our medical care system. But unfortunately, it's a useful way to show the problems with it. During the 1970s, we managed to decrease the number of black women who were pregnant, who were not receiving prenatal care. During the early 80s, that number sort of stabilized, and then during the late 80s and the 90s, it has started to rise again. So now fewer moms and their in-womb babies are receiving the sort of preventive health care that they need to make sure that both mom and baby are healthy at the time of birth. This is from a Children's Defense Fund study about 2 years ago. As a consequence, the early infant mortality among babies recently born in African Americans has essentially leveled off at a rate that is really embarrassingly high compared to most developed countries, compared to almost all developed countries. And so as you can see, we made some progress during the 1960s, again, primarily because of social anti-poverty programs, but our healthcare system has continued to prevent further progress in our infant mortality, both for blacks and whites, but it's more starkly evident in blacks during the last decade or so. Here's a comparison of our infant mortality statistics compared to other developed countries. The United States is far and away the worst, despite the fact that we spend the most on healthcare. The countries down the bottom, if you can't see that, are Italy, Australia, France, Germany, Canada, and Japan. Japan has an infant mortality rate half that of ours, and it's almost entirely due to access to care. In addition, it's not only the babies that are suffering, but also the moms. The death rate for black women, which was again declining during the 60s and 70s, stabilized during the 80s, plateaued during the 80s, stopped declining, and actually has started to increase now in the late 80s and early 90s. And at least partly, this is due to perinatal mortality, birth trauma mortality among black women. It's also due to other factors having to do with preventive care for black women. And the case is for all other, that's the case for all other racial subgroups as well. Here's one statistic that gives us more sort of aggregate number for the population at large. There's a similar curve or a similar comparison available for women in this country. Our life expectancy is several years lower than that of Japan, and somewhere between 1 and 2 years lower than almost all of the other developed countries.
Has it been updated since 1989?
Yeah, and that continues. The numbers are essentially the same. This study was based on statistics from 1990, and the study was published in 1991. So essentially, this is pretty current statistics. But and it's been, these numbers have been checked to see whether they have anything to do with, you know, genetic factors or something like that. And for the most part, they are due to access to care and our preventive health strategies, how, you know, what sort of lifestyles and what sort of health care services we provide to prevent illness. So this, I think, is even more stark. The percent of men in Harlem that are alive at age 65 is about 40%, and in Bangladesh it's 55%. That's just amazing. You know, we're one of the worst. I mean, Bangladesh is one of the developing countries that has the worst economic statistics of any. And we have pockets in our country that are worse than the worst. Okay, so it's clear that we're rationing healthcare in this country, but we're rationing it by economic status and not by any other means. People frequently complain that proposals for changes in the healthcare system are rationing and that there's no way to do that effectively. We clearly are, and we're doing it in a highly immoral way. As we've said, about a third of Americans are either inadequately insured or uninsured, and because of that, they're often denied care, and they're often sicker, and they die younger. There are some problems with the economics of our healthcare system. One of them is that there's a large number of hospital beds in this country that are unfilled. So we have, in a sense, more facilities than we need, or at least more facilities than we are currently using. Let's put it that way, more facilities than we are currently using. The number is, I think it's 100,000 hospital beds. I'm feeling a little, I've lost that number out of my... off the tip of my tongue here, but essentially there's a large excess of unused capacity in our hospitals and to some extent in our clinics in the country in general, not looked at in particular locations, but in general. In addition, in this country, we perform perhaps, this is of course debated numbers, and in any particular area you can throw pot shots at this, but it seems like we probably perform more high-tech procedures than we need to, especially in certain areas in this country. This particular slide comes from a study done by the RAND Corporation on vascular surgery, both heart surgery, which is CABG, C-A-B-G, coronary artery bypass graft, and endarterectomy, which is rotor routing of the vessels going to the head. And by stringent criteria established by various professional organizations like the American Surgeons Association and the National Internists Association, as well as a number of healthcare studies, it suggested that there are probably perhaps a third of both of these procedures, somewhere between a fifth and a third of these procedures that are done inappropriately. Part of the reason for that is that when hospitals develop and their healthcare, their physicians develop the capacity to do high-tech procedures like these, and you have to do so a certain number of them, or you're not going to be able to recoup your investment. Here's some numbers about, and there's a number of studies that document this in specific ways. I don't think anybody really knows overall how serious the duplication of technology and high technology is in this country, but it's clearly a problem in certain focused areas that have been well studied. For those of you from the Midwest, I think the bottom one will be particularly interesting. In Des Moines, which has a population of 380,000, there are two hospitals that do kidney transplants. And in 1988, those two hospitals did a total of 8 and 15 kidney transplants. One did 8, one did 15. And University Hospital, and I presume this means Iowa City, I actually didn't, I borrowed this slide, but I'm sure it's in Iowa City since that's about 100 miles away, did 69 cases of renal transplants. Because they did much more cases, and because they're a large referral center, they have the capacity to take care of those kidney transplant cases much better, also probably much cheaper. And I'm sure if you looked at over, let's say, 5 years, the statistics between how those kidney transplants did in the two centers, you'd probably find that the University Hospital cases in Iowa City did at least as well, if not a lot better, probably a lot better than the cases that were done in the hospitals that only did a few. This is the situation for a number of high-tech procedures. that are perhaps necessary, and I don't think that it's difficult to argue against, to argue that they shouldn't be done at all. I certainly think that kidney transplants probably should be available, but it certainly seems to me that they should not be done by every hospital, because that's inefficient. And it involves a lot of backup technology and a backup personnel that not every hospital should have to support on their payroll. Here's a couple other features of the economics of our healthcare system. Partly because most other developing countries have somewhat unified regulatory systems or purchasing systems for buying drugs from pharmaceutical manufacturers. They have lower costs, or at least because some developing countries, I should say that, they have lower costs for prescription drugs than we do. This is a comparison. The prescription drug prices in the United States and Holland and Germany as compared to Britain and Canada. And for this purpose, the United States, at least from the standpoint of purchasing of drugs, the United States, Holland, and Germany have very similar systems, whereas the United Kingdom and Canada have a more unified system of negotiating prices with drug companies. And Canadians, on the average, pay 60% of the price for the exact same drug manufactured in the exact same plant as we do in the U.S. They're basically using the exact same things that we're using, but they pay 60% less for prescription drugs than we do. This is also indicates what percentage of our of things that are manufactured in this country, what percentage of their costs is due to the healthcare benefits for the people who help make those things. This is from Chrysler Corporation in 88. Chrysler is generally, I think, considered, I'm no auto economist, but is generally considered to be of any the probably the most efficient health, or the most efficient and the most economical auto manufacturer in this country at present. And for Chrysler, their costs for health benefits for their employees were at least twice that of any other developing country, and more like about three times that of Canada. Here's a quick indication of what is probably economically wrong with our healthcare system. We've already seen what's morally wrong with it. Let's see what's economically wrong. This is a nurse in an intensive care unit with her uniform adorned with billing stickers from the equipment needed to put in one central intravenous access line for putting in large volumes of intravenous medicines for a patient in the intensive care unit. Required all sorts of supplies, and each of those supplies had an individual billing sticker on it, which she keeps, and then when she gets a chance on, later on when she gets a break, she pastes those into the hospital chart. And then after the patient is discharged, the chart goes down to the billing office, and the billing office laboriously records each of those stickers and prints out an itemized bill for every item that went into that particular relatively small procedure. This is the case for large procedures and operating rooms, for anything that gets done in most hospitals. This is, at least most hospitals I've been in, and this is the system how the billing is done, how you get an itemized bill from your hospital stay. Because Canada is the next largest spender to the United States, let's look at the difference between the two countries. I think that's the most useful comparison. That 40% difference in healthcare spending between the United States and Canada is more than half of it is due to differences in spending on bureaucracy. More than half of the difference between the two countries is because we have a larger, quote, bureaucracy than they have. There are other features, but the one I want to focus on is the bureaucratic aspect of it. A lot of this comes from a landmark study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is a major medical journal in the United States, about a year and a half ago. In the United States, physicians spend per person in the population about $225 on office expenses, on office overhead, things like paperwork and billing, versus $83 in Canada. In the United States, insurance processing, medical insurance processing, costs roughly 8 or 10 times or so more per capita than it does in Canada. In the United States, hospital billing costs more than 3 times as much per capita per year as it does in Canada. Again, all of these sort of in the area of bureaucracy, administration, paperwork, overhead type things. Another telling statistic, I think, and this is not necessarily the best way to do this comparison, but this is the way that it came out in the, it was the easiest way to put it in the slide. But since 1970, which is the reference year, the number of doctors in this country has increased about twofold, and that's partly as a function of the fact that our population is increasing. It's also due to a number of other features. But the number of, quote, medical administrators, people who are involved in billing and structuring things and insurance administration, basically medical bureaucrats, if you will, of which, you know, there are some doctors involved in that category too. The number of medical administrators has increased sixfold. So if you can use the number of physicians as a sort of reflection of how patient care or patient caretakers have increased, people who are actually working with individuals, and administrators as people who oversee the financial aspects of the system, the administrators have increased threefold over the number of people who are actually working with patients or with clients. I think we're going to skip this one, except to point out, well, I'm not going to go into the details, but just to point out that people sometimes say that managed care or health maintenance organizations are a more efficient system than private insurers in this country. And that's not necessarily the case. The difference between HMOs and private insurers is, for the most part, the profit and the excess sort of returns that insurance companies take from premiums. But if you're actually talking about just administrative costs, HMOs and private insurers spend about the same amount on administrating things. And that's markedly in comparison, it seems to me, to what Canada does. They spend less than 1% of their healthcare dollar on administration, whereas we spend more like 10% in this country. This is perhaps a sort of exaggerated and overblown, but I think still somewhat relevant perspective on what's wrong from an economic standpoint with and a political standpoint with healthcare in this country. This is a picture of Boston taken from the river, the Boston skyline, and handily framed to pick up two of the highest buildings in Boston. Boston, remember, is sort of the center of medical care in the world. It's where the most prestigious journal for medicine in this country is published, where probably the most prestigious hospitals and medical centers in this country are located. The world looks to the United States as sort of the innovator in medical care in some peculiar way. And here in Boston in the skyline are the John Hancock Tower and the Prudential Tower. Two major medical insurance conglomerates. The percentage of insurance, this is another way of looking at what we looked at with the previous slide, the percentage of insurance overhead as a part of our gross national product in the United States in yellow and Canada in the pink. Canada's virtually eliminated, I mean, they've gotten it down to such a small amount that basically it's zero now, private insurance. Whereas in the United States, private insurance administration is upwards close to 1% of our gross national product. That's an amazing number as far as I'm concerned. I think I'm going to stop pretty quickly here with this last thing. A perspective of how our healthcare system is viewed by people in other countries, again using Canada as the example. But this sort of statistic or this kind of polling data could be found in just about any other developed country in the world. The Harris poll the Harris Polling Organization asked this question of a bunch of Canadians back in 1988. In the United States system of healthcare, the government pays most of the cost of healthcare for the elderly, the poor, and the disabled. Most other individuals either have health insurance paid by their employers or have to buy it from an insurance company. Some have no insurance. Under the U.S. system, people can choose their own doctors and hospitals. On the balance, the poll asked the Canadians, would you prefer this U.S. system or would you prefer the system that they have in Canada? Incidentally, just to look at this question, you realize that there are a couple things about it that are sort of over rosy. One of the things is that most of us now cannot choose our own doctors and hospitals. Most of us on insurance programs have prescribed choices. The other thing is that I think it sort of understates the, especially at this point, the percentage of individuals that don't have any insurance. And it certainly underestimates the individuals that don't have adequate insurance. So when they asked this overly rosy question of the Canadians 5 or 4 years ago, Canadians said, no way. Those who preferred the U.S. system was 3%, versus those who preferred the Canadian system was 95%, versus those who didn't know was 2%. So I think it's amazing how the rest of the world, rest of the developed world anyway, views the United States healthcare system, both from a moral and probably from an economic standpoint. Okay, that's all the slides. Let me turn the lights back on. Esther, if you'd be willing to flip that to fan on the lot lines. I guess I promised, it was sort of a diatribe. I didn't allow enough time for discussion. Tomorrow's going to be a large part of discussion. But I think we've got about 5 minutes. Does anybody have anything they'd like to throw out here to? Anybody? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, my husband has cancer, and in 1988, the Catastrophic Act, along with the raise of the pay of the Congress people, well, it was passed because it was the Catastrophic Act was somewhere, either one was slipped under the other, and so mm-hmm. it went in. And so therefore, he was covered in 1989. He lived for about 6.5 months. And the insurance company, under a Medicare man, was a government worker, but he was, what do you call it, came into one of the major insurance companies. I don't want to say what company it is. But anyway, it went out at the end of the year. And the only reason why it went in is because the congressman wanted to raise.
Yeah.
Now that's the truth, because I went back and asked. And all it was is many who are senior citizens, it only took a few dollars out of your Social Security check. And this was thrown in. Mm-hmm. A lot of senior citizens rebelled because they didn't want any money taken out. My feeling was it really did a lot for our budget.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was put under hospice. And it's very interesting.
Yeah. There's been some other attempts. Back in 88, there was a significant reform of Medicare and to some extent of Medicaid. And there's been some significant attempts over the years, over the recent years, to try and sort of tinker with the government programs a little bit to expand access. And to some degree, that's been successful in a very limited way. But as you suggest, at least one of those attempts was repealed. And for the most part, even those that are still in place sort of caused a little bit of a slight flattening of the curve and the rise of the unable to pay. But basically didn't sort of staunch the exponential rise.
And he said in the Catastrophic Act, the man that worked for Medicare said too there were a lot of loopholes in it, and that's why it just was done too fast at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The question I have is, I keep reading these letters to the editor in our newspapers, and it's not a matter of cost, but they say, well, in Canada or in England or wherever, it's paid for, but you have to wait for a month or 2 months or 3 months to get your operation or your this and that or the other thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think to some extent that's true. In countries that have universal access and a single payer system, it is true that there is some rationing that partly is done through the mechanism of making people wait. But there is no evidence that in Canada or the United Kingdom, for that matter, that individuals with emergencies have to wait. And so in general, the sort of individuals that have to wait are individuals who have chronic conditions that need, that potentially can be fixed by significant operations, for example, but need to wait in a queue for that for a period of time. But the truth of the matter is that the size, the duration of the queues, the duration of the wait in those countries has been vastly, I think, overstated in this country. And in addition, probably isn't happening as much as some, I think, of the rhetoric would lead us to believe. And again, I think, you know, if queues, if lines were a major issue in Canada, that figure of preference would be vastly different. If people had to wait for things that they desperately needed, even, you know, occasionally if they had to wait, or rarely if they had to wait for things they desperately needed right away, that number of satisfaction would be...